UK government might have shut down?
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Good morning. I'm Roland Martin, broadcasting live from the campus of the University of Arkansas Pine Bluff in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Coming up next on News One Now, the fate of President Trump's Muslim travel ban is now in the hands of a San Francisco appeals court. That'll be heard later today when the DOJ and lawyers for two states opposed to the ban go at it in court. Speaking of Trump, yesterday he accused the national news media of not covering a number of terrorist attacks when the media did. Why does the president continue to lie? We'll break that down with our panel as well. Here in Arkansas, we will talk at one of Little Rock Nine. It was 60 years ago in September where the nation was gripped by more than 11,000 federal troops escorting nine black kids into Central High School. We will talk with one of Little Rock Nine right here on News One Now. Also, today is National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day, and we'll look at how the disease is affecting black America and what needs to be done. And also, we'll pay tribute to a frequent contributor right here on News One Now, retired Major General John Hawk Hawkins, who passed away on Friday. It's time to bring the funk on News One Now on TV One. Folks, for the past several days, the nation's been gripped in protests all across the country after President Trump's team imposed an executive order putting in place a ban on folks traveling from seven countries. Now, the Trump team says this is not a ban on Muslims, when critics say it absolutely is. Several federal judges have ruled against the administration, saying that it is unconstitutional. Now they are going to go to court. Oral arguments will take place today, 6 p.m. Eastern, in a court in San Francisco. The Justice Department, they are trying to reinstate the travel ban that was put on hold by a Seattle judge on Friday. Now, since the lower court suspension, foreign nationals from seven predominantly Muslim countries have been traveling to the United States, making their way here. President Trump has severely criticized the judge, James Robart, and said he'd hold him accountable if the U.S. were attacked. This is what Trump tweeted. Quote, just cannot believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something happens, blame him and court system. People pouring in, bad. Now, among the growing opposition to Trump's travel ban, more than 100 tech companies have filed a legal brief siding with the states fighting the ban. Yesterday, also, the opposition continued, and for some reason, Trump, speaking to troops in Tampa, Florida, said the ban is part of the fight against terrorism.
We will defeat radical Islamic terrorism, and we will not allow it to take root in our country. We're not going to allow it. We need strong programs so that people that love us and want to love our country and will end up loving our country are allowed in, not people that want to destroy us and destroy our country.
A three-judge panel will hear the appeal by phone, issue their ruling. There's no doubt, no matter what happens here, it will be appealed to the Supreme Court, of course, which sits 4-4 for conservatives as well as for liberals. Joining us via Skype is Ghadir Abbas, an attorney for the Council on American-Islamic Relations. They filed a lawsuit in a federal court in Virginia last month challenging Trump executive order. Also joining us in D.C. is Gianna Caldwell, Republican strategist at Caldwell Consulting. Avis Jones DeWeaver, leadership strategist, author of How Exceptional Black Women Lead. Tiffany Lofton, she, of course, is an education and labor union organizer. All right, first of all, I want to go to you first, Ghadir. when you listen to the president talk about this is fighting terrorism, the seven countries, there's no evidence that individuals from those seven countries have committed terrorist acts. And so, again, the rationale that he is offering makes no sense.
That's absolutely right. This is what he described it as in his campaign. This is a ban on Muslim immigration. And one very important thing to know is that while this does not apply to all Muslims in the world, this ban only applies to Muslims. The text of the executive order itself provides a means for people that are not Muslim from these seven countries to immigrate to the U.S. And that's, I think, a really important thing that's being lost in the mix. There isn't a dispute about what the executive order does, and we don't have to even rely on Donald Trump's words, the words of his close advisors, because the text itself makes it very clear that this is about religious discrimination more than it is about national security.
Good year. I was reading a New York Times story today, and it said that some 15,000 doctors in America would come from these seven countries. That's a problem because you're now putting the health care of American citizens in jeopardy.
And you're also, I would not be here. My parents immigrated from Iraq in the 1980s as students. I would not be here. My relatives would not be here. And there's a lot of folks that have made significant contributions to the United States that would not be here because of the immigration ban, the Muslim ban that has been imposed by Donald Trump. And so really what has made the United States stronger than some European countries, than Japan and other nations, is its willingness and openness to accept immigration. You see in modern post-industrialized nations this phenomenon of decreasing populations, and immigration in the United States offsets that natural tendency for richer countries to be less producing of children. And so here, what I think is really important is that at the end of the day, the Constitution forbids Donald Trump from utilizing his authority in a way that discriminates against Muslims, discriminates against Islam, and the courts are checking him against it.
All right, Goodyear, we certainly appreciate you joining us, and certainly good luck when it comes to this legal challenge.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Also yesterday, we told you anytime Donald Trump lies, we're going to play this. So I've never understood how this president continues to lie. Yesterday, speaking in Tampa, this is what he accused the media of doing.
You've seen what happened in Paris and Nice. All over Europe, it's happening. It's gotten to a point where it's not even being reported. And in many cases, the very, very dishonest press doesn't want to report it. They have their reasons, and you understand that.
All right, Gianna, I want to go to you first. Last I check, when we had attacks in Europe, literally, American news media had wall-to-wall coverage. The terrorist attack, San Bernardino, California, wall-to-wall coverage. And so I'm trying to understand, why does this man keep lying when the facts simply can disprove anything that he says?
Well, certainly when it comes to Paris and San Bernardino, those were two instances that were covered widely. But the truth of the matter is, there is something going on in the press where we see a plethora of fake news being reported. I'll give you a good example, especially when we're talking about this travel ban. The fact that...
No, Gianno.
What?
I'm specifically asking you about Trump's comments with regards to saying the media is not covering terrorist attacks that are happening in Europe. That's the subject, that's a discussion, and that's a lie.
And again, I said, certainly where it comes to Paris and St. Bernardino,
that's
inaccurate.
Belgium.
That's inaccurate.
It wasn't just those two. They put out this list of all of these different terrorist attacks, here's what the hilarious part is, Avis. They call the list from media sources.
Oh, my God. Okay. I mean, what can you say to that? Here's what's going on with this White House. What he's looking to develop is a propaganda machine, right? He is looking to basically sabotage the public's trust in the media, specifically, obviously, projecting to his supporters, and get them into a situation in which they're manipulated into only believing what comes out of his mouth. This is one of the tenets of fascism, and I would just have to sort of point out that what we have in this country right now is a White House that's been taken over by a fascist regime. And until we call it what it is, we're not going to be able to mount the level of attack that we need to mount against it. This is just one example of a way that we're going that's very dangerous. And unless we call it out and say what it is, which is a lie over and over again, they'll continue to try to get away with
it. Well, if I can follow up to that, people have began to distrust the media over the course of decades. This isn't something new. And this plethora of fake news stories that we're seeing coming out from either side, whether it be the left or the right or just mainstream in general, is allowing people to say, man, maybe this guy is being honest about this.
No,
because
Let me be clear. We're discussing what the president said about the total issue of terrorism. Here's what he also said, Tiffany, in a tweet. He said, don't believe any negative polls.
Yep. He said all negative polls.
So we're supposed to only believe polls that are positive in your favor. Again, I think Amos is right, Tiffany. What you have here is this is an administration that wants to lie with impunity, make up things, and say, oh, no, no. Trust me when the facts simply can be proven. We have covered terrorist attacks. San Bernardino, those folks were from Pakistan. They're not on the banned list. The 9/11, from most of the hijackers from Saudi Arabia, not one of the seven countries. Yeah.
Right. No, this is before he was elected president. There's been a lot of dog whistle politics that have been happening and going on where he has tried to create a them versus us, a them versus us. We don't know yet who the us is, because every time we try to get in the us, he tries to divide and conquer that as well. And when we're talking about the tweets that are happening from yesterday, Roland, the one that you just quoted, his tweet said any negative polls are fake news. That is very dangerous. Gianna's right. Media, and we have not been able to trust it for decades. That is definitely a fact, and that's definitely true. I have been very critical over the press that we read, and thank God for social media that has been able to sort of dispel some of those truths and dispel some of those myths that come out. But when you have a president who is clearly taking sides, and when it comes to attacking the media, when you have a president who says, if it's not in my favor, then it's not true, that is very dangerous, Roland, because there are folks in this country who voted for this person. He did not win the popular vote. I'm gonna keep saying that. But there are folks who believe this person, who believe this president, who voted for this man, who feel like, okay, anything that comes out of his mouth is going to be true. And he has passed, even with the EPA, he told the EPA weeks ago, listen, before, if there's any data or statistics that come out, you are not allowed to tell the rest of the country anything about the EPA until you run it by me first. He wants to control the truth and narrative of this entire country.
Period. And with the media, with his tweets,
he is saying, if it's not coming from me, then it's not true.
Gianna, you're not going to lie on this show.
So, Roland, Gianna, listen, I want to ask you a question.
Excuse me, Gianna. McClatchy Newspapers reported today that all across the administration, they are not responding to information. They're taking information down. They're not even responding to various requests in multiple agencies. Dude, what the hell is going on when this administration does not want to provide information to the American people? That is a factual story.
Again, when I said that every administration has a way and a process of doing things, an organization, and with specific federal agencies, they are, before releasing information, generally speaking, rolling in the past someone at the White House.
That is
that's
true.
How it goes, and that's how it's been going.
Executive orders to make it mandatory, though, but, and that's a
But again, Gianno, when you have complete denial, when you have an administration that refuses to even respond to requests, in fact, the White House, the Obama White House, had a policy that if a petition on the White House achieved more than 100,000 signatures,
they must respond, right?
This White House doesn't respond.
So let me.
In fact, the phone line to the White House for citizens to be able to call in and offer their perspective, that phone line doesn't even work anymore. So again, this administration does not want to hear from the American people.
But let me ask you this, Roland.
No, they don't.
So you're
Gianno, will you stop making excuses?
No, I'm not making excuses, Roland. I'm asking you honest about this. That's what
I'm being very honest.
No, you're not.
I'm being very honest.
It's just like with the White House website. People say, oh, there's no LGBT tab. There's no this, that, and the other. Just to say that an administration doesn't change the website when they take over. They do every time.
No.
This is the second week of an administration.
Gianno,
maybe now.
That's nice spin. I'm not talking about information coming off the White House website. I'm talking about a refusal to even respond to the request from American citizens. Hold tight one second. When we come back, we're going to talk about Democrats being up all night speaking on the Senate floor opposing the nomination of Betsy DeVos. Can they convince one more Republican to vote against her to torpedo her nomination for Secretary of Education? Also on the show today, we'll talk with one of the members of the Little Rock Nine about that experience 60 years ago that gripped the nation and the world when it comes to federal troops had to escort black kids simply trying to get an education. Also, Eddie Glaude will be on the show talking about his book, an NAACP Image Award nominee. All of that next, News One Now on TV One Live from the University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Betsy DeVos for Education Secretary. In my mind, she is the least qualified nominee in a historically unqualified cabinet.
She is someone who has dedicated her career and her inherited fortune to privatizing public schools, to tearing down public education.
No matter her secrecy, no matter her blowing off basic anti-corruption practices, they will ram this nomination down the throats of the American people sideways.
Democrats were up all night on the Senate floor speaking about the opposition to Betsy DeVos to be the education secretary. Thousands upon thousands of phone calls have poured into Capitol Hill from people all across the country not wanting her to be confirmed as Secretary of Education. Now, the United States Senate is split 52-48. Republicans have 52 seats. Democrats have 48 seats. Two Republicans have already said they're not going to vote for her. The opposition, they're trying to get one more Republican to vote against Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. If it ends in a tie, 50-50, Vice President Mike Pence will cast the deciding vote that will confirm her as the next Secretary of Education. Let's go to our panel to discuss this. I'll start with you, Tiffany. This is an example of, out of all his nominees, this is the most heat they're placing on any nominee.
No, absolutely, Roland. I talked to my cousins in New Orleans who don't even pay attention to politics, and they were like, yo, this woman who's about to be appointed for Department of Education, she does not look qualified. And I was like, yeah, she doesn't look qualified because she isn't qualified. Good job. And if they're not paying attention to anything else, like you said, Roland, this is the one where the picture has been painted the most clearly. And it is unfortunate that even despite all of that, her track record, her lack of experience, her video being called out and bashed by Senator Warren, etc., she still might today get approved, and or tomorrow. I think they've delayed the vote now for 2 days. She still might get approved, and it's hurtful to see commercials that come up by Donald Trump, that said President Donald Trump, that say, okay, we want to vote for the winning team. She is not a winner. She's not a winning team, and she's not for public education. She doesn't have any experience dealing with public education system, nor have her kids, and she's benefited from private corporations and from private money. And so, if she does get elected, it's going to say appointed. It's going to say a lot of things about our democracy system, but it's also going to say a lot about what happens to higher education in the future, and it won't be good. And teachers and students across this country are going to have to fight for a lot while she's in office.
Gianna, I'm a school choice supporter. She supports school choice. She supports vouchers. But the issue here goes beyond school choice. She could not even answer the question as to whether or not she would enforce Title IX. She then said, when asked about a federal law that deals with education for students who are disabled, she said, leave it up to the states. It's a federal law. The fundamental problem I have here is that to be Secretary of Education, first of all, charter schools only represent 3% of all kids in public schools. And so to have a nominee whose focus is only that, as opposed to the vast array of responsibilities of a Secretary of Education, that's a whole different beast. And this is why folks have a fundamental problem with her being Education Secretary.
I can see there be some considerations in which people have in deciding to support her, but that now we see what's going on in the Senate, and I think this is where the debates actually occur. We're seeing that when it comes to Democrats and Republicans, with you noting two Republicans not supporting her. My issue isn't about the, you know, her saying, oh, am I going to enforce this law, that law per se. It's about, do you have an agenda that's going to be beneficial and equitable in education across the board for all students? As you said, you're a proponent of charter schools, so am I. And I believe that she is a qualified candidate, although some do disagree.
A lot of people disagree.
Hold up. I just asked you the question. I just stated in the hearing, Gianna.
Yes.
She said, when asked about a federal law that dealt with students with disabilities, she said,
leave it up to the states.
It's a federal law. If you don't understand the basics of a federal law, how in the world can you be Education Secretary?
Well, if we're going to. Sure, sure, certainly, yeah.
Well, Donald Trump is in office.
No, I'm not going to say that. No, that's
don't
not what I'm
spin
saying.
It.
Sure, that's
Avis,
that's
Avis, go ahead. Avis, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's a lot, clearly, that she doesn't understand. Her entire confirmation was like an extended comedy routine, if it wasn't so tragic.
Come on.
Yes, it was. What's really sad also, but this is very serious, is that she's also saying that one of the things that she does want to do is to significantly weaken the Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Education, which we know is absolutely critical in terms of making sure that students of color and that girls receive the adequate attention and are not disproportionately impacted negatively in the public school experience. She's never been in a public school classroom. She's never taught. She's never been an administrator. In fact, I would argue that the reason why she's there is because of her billionaire status and having donated to probably every Republican that's in the Senate in which we'll be voting on her. So, no, she's not qualified, and she doesn't need to be in that position.
All right, folks, hold tight 1 second. When we come back, we'll talk about one of the members of the Little Rock Nine. It was 60 years ago in September when the world saw America, white America, trying to enforce Jim Crow to keep black kids out of a public high school in Little Rock, Arkansas. We'll talk with one of those members about what it was like going through the tumultuous times and being escorted to school by federal troops. Also, we'll talk with Professor Eddie Glaude about his new book dealing with democracy. It is a nominee for an NAACP Image Award. And also, today is National Black HIV AIDS Awareness Day, and we'll discuss that very important issue as well. All of that next, News One Now on TV One Live from the University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Folks, welcome back to News One Now, broadcasting live from the University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. We're about 40-plus miles away from Little Rock, where history was made in that city some 60 years ago in September. September. And so what took place was that, again, 9 African-American kids were trying to go to school just to simply get an education, just to get an education, when whites in Arkansas said absolutely not. The governor of Arkansas, Orville Faubus, made it clear he was not going to allow that to happen. As a result, President Dwight Eisenhower was forced to send in federal troops to escort those 9 children to class. And of course, it shocked the nation to see this, to literally see federal troops escorting children into school. It was stunning. It was shocking. And of course, you see the video there. Yesterday, I came here, I stopped by the visitor center there in Little Rock, Arkansas, which is a national historic site, and also dropped by the school as well. We have some of that video. Of course, Little Rock 9, they've been honored all across the world, but certainly in Arkansas as well. And so, like I said, that high school, and we can show some of the video, folks, of the actual what I shot yesterday. The school still is in operation. It still is in operation. And in fact, a multi-racial group of students who are there, 2,500 students, of course, fill that school as well. One of the folks who made history in those 3 days in September joins me. She is Elizabeth Eckford, and again, was one of the Little Rock 9. As you see, this is video yesterday that I shot there at the Visitor Center. And Elizabeth joins me right now. Elizabeth, how you doing?
Fine.
We're certainly glad to have you here.
Thank you.
It was very interesting for me. It was emotional as well to walk those grounds, to walk up those steps, and then to peer into the windows and to see black students, white students, Hispanic students, all in class together, when it was a whole different scene some 60 years ago.
Yes. Then there was a lot of opposition that had been organized during the summer. Before that, there was no public opposition. But within the school, there was an organized group that followed us and attacked us. It was a very, very difficult year.
And when you think back on those days in September, were you and others fearful?
Yes. Each of us had a soldier guard who followed us several paces behind. They could see what was happening, but they were not in a position to intervene. I remember one occasion, we would make reports to the vice principals every day, and the soldier that was following me that day said he didn't see that. So the next day, when somebody body slammed me into a wall locker, which was part of the daily routine, I turned around and grabbed the person next to me, and I asked the soldier, "Did you see that?"
So you and the students, you literally had soldiers following you to class.
Yes, they didn't enter any class. They followed us in the hallways.
And so you're trying to go to school. And that's the thing I think that still is tough to grapple with. You're just trying to get education. You're just trying to go to school. And I tell people all the time to understand how deep Jim Crow and racism was in America, when that was such a fight to keep black children from getting an education.
Yes, the basis of racism, to put it simply, is that one group thinks that they're more entitled than another.
When you look at Central High School today, the fact that it's still in operation, when you look at the student body now, for me, it's bothersome to think of kids today who don't take school as seriously, knowing full well you had to have 11,000 troops to walk y'all into a school. Your thoughts about that?
Well, that was very significant. That was one of the two times in the whole country where an elected official had actually acted to enforce a court order regarding desegregation. I always refer to it as desegregation because we were never considered as other students.
When you look at education today, when you still see that essentially we have returned to segregated schools.
Yes.
What I explain to folks is that we're based upon neighborhoods, and what we're also seeing right here is video, folks. That is the monument that is on the Arkansas State Capitol grounds of the Little Rock Nine as well. That's the marker there when it was dedicated. And again, it is, if you get a chance to go to Little Rock, definitely drop by to see that monument. Again, it's amazing how even though you don't see mobs of whites standing outside of schools, you still see efforts to have segregated schools.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There are some situations where there are old white classrooms because I don't think that the white students go there for a diverse environment. Mm-hmm. They go there for the educational program that is available there. There was an article recently in the paper about trying to increase equity of opportunity in the schools. Central High has available more advanced placement classes than any other school in the district.
Mm-hmm.
And with that kind of reputation, it draws students to that school. But until the district announced that they were going to give more people an opportunity to get in those classes, most of those classes were all white.
And that's the thing that I think, again, when we begin to break down understanding education, there's this attitude that, we're all on the same page. We're all getting the same education. When the reality is, when you look at whether you talk about advanced classes, whether you talk about having teachers with master's degrees and PhDs as opposed to others teaching black children with no certification, I mean, at the end of the day, we still have two separate school systems in America.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Except in the Little Rock district, I don't think you'll find non-certified teachers in any school.
Well, thank goodness, thank goodness. I mean, we certainly see that in other schools as well. Last question for you. What would you want a student today? How old were you when this was?
I was 15 going on 16.
What would you want a 15-year-old today to understand about that moment 60 years ago?
That was an effort to enact the promise of America. You know, that when they said that there were inalienable rights, they were talking about white property owners. The court said that segregation in and of itself increased a sense of inferiority among the people that was inflicted upon. I still see that today. I still hear people talking about good hair being affected by the colors within us. And but I say to students that education is an opportunity for you to create opportunities in the future, and that you have to believe that you can achieve. You have to work hard to achieve. A lot of people, I think, don't realize their potential.
Well, absolutely. And I think a lot of folks have been denied the opportunity as well. And so, like I keep telling folks, you got to keep fighting, no matter what the cost. And then if folks oppose you, well, then you keep fighting again.
That's right.
Elizabeth, we certainly appreciate it. Thanks so much. Thank you for all you and others did 60 years ago.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a bunch, folks. When we come back, we'll talk with Eddie Glaude about democracy in America. Can't wait to get his take on the madness of a Donald Trump presidency just 3 weeks in. Plus, today is National Black HIV AIDS Awareness Day, and we'll also talk with the CDC about efforts to drive more funding to African-American groups when it comes to the issue of HIV/AIDS. This is News One Now, broadcasting live from University of Arkansas Pine Bluff on TV One. Back in a moment.
So you want the truth? Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
The NAACP Image Awards airs on TV One on Saturday from Pasadena, California. And one of the folks hoping to bring home an Image Award is our next guest, Dr. Eddie Glaude, professor at Princeton. His book has been nominated for an Image Award. It is Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. Nominated in the Outstanding Literary Work Nonfiction category. And so glad to have Eddie back on the show via Skype. Eddie, how you doing?
I'm good, Roland. How are you? And thanks for making that happen.
Doing great. Say it again.
Thanks for helping make that happen with the NAACP Image Awards, because I came on your show to talk about that book.
Well, not a problem. And so hopefully you'll bring home an award. And I got nominated for Outstanding Host, and hopefully I get my third one as well. So let's talk about this issue. It's very interesting. I just had this conversation with Elizabeth Eckford, one of the Little Rock Nine. Mm-hmm. And I think about your book as well. And reality is we are still literally battling when it comes to America, to African Americans being fully free Americans. 398 years after 20-odd Africans arrived in 1619, and even after Reconstruction, even after the Great Compromise, even after the Jim Crow, Black Freedom Movement, you name it, Black Power Movement, we are still trying to be fully free Americans.
I mean, it's so true. I'm just... And I said during my speech that the main thing is that Donald Trump isn't new to us, that this particular moment isn't new, that it's familiar, that it's just simply a reassertion of what I call in the book the value gap. The value gap is the fundamental belief that white people matter more than others, and that belief continues to animate this society. And we've been struggling against it, struggling to make real the promise of democracy since we were brought here. So, you know, we talk about, you know, how dangerous Trump is and how meaningful his election was to white America, to working class white America. But we know what this is. And like you said, it's just the latest instance in our long struggle in this country to be free.
And when we talk about this fight to be free, when you literally have white Americans, and we look at the polling data, who other believe, oh, enough has been done for African Americans. King wrote about this, Dr. King did, in Chaos or Community, Where Do We Go From Here? He wrote about this in 1967, saying this was going to happen.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in that wonderful text, Dr. King makes this point. He basically says, as long as white Americans believe that racial equality is a philanthropic enterprise, that it's charitable, that it's charity, then we will never achieve genuine racial equality in this country. That racial justice is the equivalent of white people doing a favor for us, right? Doing us a favor. And you know, when I think back on the Little Rock Nine, as I listened to the interview, and I remember reading Mary Batillo Bills's wonderful book, Warriors Don't Cry. And you think about the sacrifices of what James Baldwin described as of those spiritual aristocrats to really make real the promises of democracy. It just simply emboldens me, because I think we stand in an amazing tradition, Roland. We stand in an amazing tradition of extraordinary people who have fought back against this nonsense. And we're going to fight back right now. We're going to continue to fight.
Now, I know our panelists have a question. We'll start with Avis.
Hi, so good to speak with you. I have a, you know, one question about one of the more controversial aspects of your book. So one of the arguments that you make in your book as it relates to this last election was that to send a message to the Democratic Party that blacks should just vote down ballot and not vote for the president. Now, given that we know that we had a very sort of uniquely dangerous Republican candidate, that, you know, in many instances, one could argue that that was a very dangerous tactic. We know that in Michigan, for example, that 90,000 people who voted did exactly what you prescribed in your book. They voted down ballot and they didn't vote for the president. Yet, Hillary lost that state only by 11,000 votes. Do you feel like pushing that narrative around making a statement with this particular presidential candidate and at this particular time was the most wise of decisions?
I don't regret writing that at the time. I had in mind that it was going to be an election between Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. I wrote a piece in Time magazine with the political scientist from Columbia, Frederick Harris, asking black folk to strategically vote now that the Republican Party had nominated Donald Trump, saying that if you lived in a decidedly blue or red state, you could vote your conscience or you could blank out. But if you lived in a battleground state, you should vote for Hillary Clinton. But I don't regret it. I think Hillary Clinton's campaign in Michigan was a disaster. Her campaign in Wisconsin was a disaster. If they had registered the 25, if they had registered the over a million black and brown voters in Florida, just spent $25 million in Florida to register those unregistered folks, they could have won Florida, but they did refuse to spend the money. Instead, they spent it on television. They were too busy trying to appeal to Bush Republicans as opposed to activating its base. So I think on the one hand, I wanted us to recognize the catastrophe, as Cornel West says, the catastrophe of Donald Trump. But we have to be very, very clear that we got to push the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party has been complicit in this mess. To my mind, and I'll say this, and I know it's a controversial statement, y'all, Donald Trump is just an exaggerated indication of the rot that's at the heart of this country. And that's not just a Republican problem. That's all of us. And particularly the Democratic Party. So I don't regret it. I appreciate the attribution of influence with regards to folks outside of Detroit and Flint, but I think it had a lot to do with the way the Clinton campaign was run.
Gotcha.
I've got to end it there because we have to talk about, of course, AIDS Awareness Day. And so, all right folks, show the book again, Eddie Glaude's book. Pull it up, please. It is now in paperback. The book is now in paperback. It is Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul, Eddie Glaude Jr. Anyway, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Hey, man, I appreciate you. Y'all take care.
All right, folks, when we come back, News One Now, we'll talk about today being National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day. We'll talk with official of the CDC. Plus, we'll also honor one of our military contributors to News One Now, who passed away on Friday, Major General John Hawkins. All of that next, News One Now on TV One.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Folks, today is National Black HIV AIDS Awareness Day, and this disease still has a fundamental impact on African Americans. In fact, the CDC previously reported, as we reported last year, that one in two black men who are gay will get the HIV virus. That is a stunning number. The question is, what is being done to halt this? What is also being done to drive resources to African Americans as well? Right now, this year's theme is I Am My Brother's Sister Keeper, Fight HIV AIDS. And so, of course, blacks account for 58% of all new HIV infections among adults and adolescents. Among all African Americans diagnosed with HIV in 2014, 73% were men, 26% were women, 57% were black, gay, or bisexual men. African-American women led women of all races who were diagnosed with HIV in 2004. Joining us on the phone is Dr. Eugene McCrae, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Division of HIV AIDS Prevention. Dr. McCrae, first and foremost, we reported the CDC numbers, but the question still is, are the resources being properly targeted to African Americans, especially places in the South? I'm here in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and the CDC had a report several years ago showing the explosion of HIV/AIDS in the South, even on HBCU campuses.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on your show. Let me start by just saying that the NBAD, our National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day, is an important moment to really build a bunch of successes that we've had, as well as close the gaps in fighting HIV in Black communities. But specific to your questions, we've made tremendous accomplishments over the last years targeting Black communities and the South in terms of reallocating resources and having very targeted efforts that are addressing HIV in the Black community, specifically among Black women and among Black African-American men, especially men who have sex with men. And those results, those targeted efforts have yielded results, but good results. For example, we're seeing tremendous declines in HIV. Black women, for example, we've seen tremendous declines in HIV over the last 5 years, and such that the gap between HIV diagnosis in Black women and white women is closing. However, we still have progress that we need to make, because Black women still account for about 16% of people who women who are living with HIV. African-American women are about 16 times as likely to receive an HIV diagnosis than white women.
All right. One of our panelists has a question. That's Tiffany, you first.
It's really, really alarming. And Roland, I'm really glad that you asked the question around resources that are being directed into the community. That's a very important question. We can talk about alienating people all we want to with this disease, but when we talk about the treatment for it and the access to that treatment, that's a very critical question. My question is, for folks who are asking or want to know the questions around the best and the most affordable ways to get access to this care, or for testing, which is what we need to, you know, talk about for today, what, I guess, are the different resources or avenues that folks can take the first step into finding that information out? Do they look online to a website? Is there a particular, you know, book that they should read? What are the resources that you advise folks to look into today?
Well, people can certainly start by checking out the CDC HIV website, cdc.gov/HIV. But in each of your state health department will also have websites that you can go to that will tell you in each of your states what's available in terms of where you can go to get tested, both in clinical and non-clinical settings. And then, of course, there is also AIDS.gov, which is another site that you can go to that can tell you about where you can get tested. So there are many resources out there available for people to learn where they can go to get tested.
And all those testings are free, right?
For most of the testing is free, but if you go to your private provider, if you get tested by your private provider, they may charge you a fee or charge your insurance a fee.
Got it.
Gianno, real quick, you have a question?
Yeah, so we know that George Bush put a lot of money in HIV/AIDS prevention, and that's something that we know. Did President Obama build on that, and what can people do who perhaps want to give for the fight against HIV?
Yes, I stated that we've made a tremendous progress in HIV prevention among African Americans in recent years, largely due to a number of contributing factors. One of the things that did happen, ACA did help us increase HIV testing and treatment, and those were all important things. But the thing that I can say is that the numbers continue to show that African Americans are more affected by HIV than any other racial ethnic groups in the nation. And among African Americans living with HIV, too many are not getting the treatment that they need. So the findings that were mentioned earlier really underscores the importance of us to continue to do HIV testing of treatment and prevention among African Americans to help us continue to advance the fight against HIV that we've made tremendous progress in over the last 10 years.
All right, Dr. McCray, we surely appreciate you joining us here at TV1. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Folks, when we come back on TV1, we'll remember one of our military contributors who passed away on Friday. That's next, News 1 Now, TV1.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV1.
Thank you for having me on your show and calling me John as opposed to Hawk on a golf course. To sustain a win of a battle, one must get into the hearts and minds of those that are fighting against you. You must make sure, before you start talking about substantial, quantifiable nation building, we must first make sure that folks are safe. Before we wrote our own Constitution, mm-hmm. we had to first make sure that we were safe. And that is critical. You can't build schools, you cannot populate schools if folks are afraid to come outside.
Folks, some sad news to report. You saw the gentleman there, Major General John R. Hawkins III, who was a frequent military contributor to News 1 Now on TV1 and Washington Watch. Well, John passed away on Friday. He spent 30 years in the military, various roles. He retired as the Director of Human Resources Policy in the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff, a graduate of Howard University, and also earned a master's as well as a law degree from American University. Again, he was a very good friend of this show. As I said, he passed away on Friday, the age of 67. And so we certainly want to send condolences out to his family. His funeral will take place this week here in Washington, D.C. And so we'll simply fade to black in memory of Hawk. News 1 Now, TV1.
Your centerpiece for black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.